Welcome to the first edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast. I am your host, David Jablinowitz, and we have with us Jerusalem Post editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz and news editor and coronavirus analyst Maayan Hoffman. The cabinet has been meeting recently to work on a plan for Israel to exit from what was a nearly 40-day lockdown. We're going to talk about that, about how Israel is exiting, how the government is managing the crisis, and also some of our country's successes, like our vaccination campaign. But first, let's talk about what's going on in Israel in general. The final pre-trial hearing for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu opened on Monday. The four-hour event was meant to decide on when witnesses would be called up to testify in three cases involving the Prime Minister. They're called by the numbers 1,000, 2,000, and 4,000. Yaakov, explain what we're talking about.
Well, that's the $1,000 question, right? For the Prime Minister, the big news, right, was obviously this is the last of the pre-trial hearings. The judges are setting the date of when the witnesses will be called to deliver and give their testimony, and which will basically be this long process, but we'll find the Prime Minister sitting in a courtroom for what could be 3 to 4 days a week, for hours on end. That's not where Prime Minister Netanyahu wants to see himself. That's not where he would be in a position of strength. And the question is, well, how will this impact the elections, really? I mean, that's kind of the most immediate effect or question that everyone's wondering. Will having the Prime Minister in a courtroom impact the elections? Will it not? Does his trial really make people change their mind of the way they plan to vote? My hunch, for what it's worth, is that people who are against Netanyahu are against Netanyahu. People are for Netanyahu despite the trial. They maybe buy into the narrative that this is a conspiracy by the left-wing media, prosecution, attorney general, court system, etc. And they'll vote for him anyhow. Where it could maybe change something is in those people who were not going to vote for him to actually go out in larger numbers and vote for someone against him. Right. And that could potentially undermine and hurt him. But we have to wait to see. I wouldn't expect a massive shift in voting.
Can I ask you about the Knesset speaker, Yariv Levin of Netanyahu's Likud party, said the trial shouldn't be taking place now during campaign.
By the way, that's concerning, David, because you have a someone who's a Knesset speaker who's in a position of significant authority and one of the highest level positions in Israel, the speaker of our parliament, who is using his parliamentary authority or so-called status to try to undermine a criminal proceeding, right? The Prime Minister has been indicted for fraud, bribery, and breach of trust. Not to mention the fact that Yariv Levin is one of the witnesses who has been listed as a potential witness on behalf of the prosecution. So there's even something of a conflict of interest here, right? I actually think, my personal opinion, the trial needs to continue. It needs to move fast. And for two main reasons. One is because if the Prime Minister is innocent, he deserves to be acquitted and to go back to focusing on what he should be focusing on. But also, just as important, is because of these claims of a conspiracy theory, there are people who buy into that. And once the witnesses start to deliver testimony, once the case starts to get some clarity, people will know whether that's true or it's not true. And that's important for Israel and Israel's rule of law, Israel's democracy, Israel's criminal justice system. We need to get some clarity.
You talk about, you know, sitting in a courtroom 4 days a week, you said, I think, right? And how that would affect an election campaign. How about affecting the running of the country from Corona to Iran to whatever else with which the Prime Minister has to deal? Sitting in a courtroom instead?
Obviously, that's not something that we would want to have happen. And there's plenty of other issues that this Prime Minister needs to deal with. First and foremost, of course, is Corona, which Maayan can talk to a little bit about what's been happening there. But I'll just say is that, you know, running Israel is obviously going to be hard on any given day. But especially when you have Iran, which is pursuing obviously a nuclear capability, and there's coordination that needs to be done now very delicately with the new administration in Washington. We're facing new elections in the Palestinian Authority. There's obviously the health and economic crisis, the political crisis, and to have to spend all your time in a courtroom, not something that, you know, does any country.
So we'll get to Maayan in just a moment about Corona. But first, Yaakov, on the political echelon, first of all, continuing with that theme, Israel is going to the elections. You were alluding to it. It's March 23rd. That's when it's scheduled to take place. On February 4th, right, a number of days ago, the finalists, that was the deadline by which the lists that are running in this upcoming election had to be submitted by to the Central Elections Committee. polls are showing, or at least starting to show, that the center left or the right could form a coalition, a government coalition. But a lot depends apparently on one man, I understand, one man and his party, Naftali Bennett. And the question being, will he agree to join Netanyahu or opt for someone who was once actually Netanyahu's finance minister, Yair Lapid, but who has also served as opposition leader? What's the answer to all of that?
I don't know. Bennett has obviously presented himself as the kingmaker in these elections. He wants to be prime minister. Unlikely to see that happening with the numbers that he's polling at, which is about 10, 11, or 12, depending on the day. But definitely what that does is puts him in a position that he could go with any government that potentially is to be formed, right? He has not been, he's not one of those people who has said, I will not sit with Netanyahu. But he's been very vague on that, which means he could potentially sit with Netanyahu. And therefore, whoever has 61, if Netanyahu gets it with Bennett, with the ultra-Orthodox parties, that could potentially be the government that he would join. If Netanyahu does not have 61, but there's 61 on the other side with Lapid, Gideon Saar, Yisrael Beiteinu, Avigdor Lieberman, and some of the other parties, then he could potentially go with them. So that really gives him the ability to be more versatile, more flexible and dynamic, and to be able to sit with anyone. He'll be the kingmaker, which means that whatever he'll want in a future government will be, that high price tag will have to be paid.
The kingmaker had been Avigdor Lieberman. Now everyone's talking about what, Naftali Bennett will be the one to
something
decide.
Something has to change in an election.
Exactly. Right. So maybe Albert Einstein wasn't right. Maybe things do change if you do it over and over
at
again.
At some point, something changes. That's right. That's right.
So Mayan, in terms of the outgoing government, right, was branded as a corona cabinet, right? And, well, there is the body called the cabinet, but it was supposed to be a government that was specifically to deal with the corona crisis. Simplistic question. Has it succeeded?
Well, I don't think there's really a question if it succeeded. I think everybody knows that it hasn't succeeded, hence the reason that it fell apart. And, you know, the recent tapes that were released on the various news stations of what went on during those cabinet meetings shows and really highlights the infighting that has happened among the different members of the part of the government. But also we can look back and we can see that Israel has upwards of 5,000 people who have died of the virus. In some ways, you know, we can say that's a low number when you look worldwide. But if you actually look at some of the other countries who are somewhat comparable to us, more island type countries, it's relatively high. Our economy is shot. People are out of work. We've had more days out of school for our children than any other country in the world, and more days on lockdown. So I don't think anybody can necessarily say that the coronavirus was handled in a good way.
So in other words, as you alluded to again, a recording of infighting, not the only time we've heard of infighting within the outgoing government again. So how much has politics played a decision in terms of what goes on and in terms of what the government has decided? Was it more political, or did they really, even if were these earnest differences of opinion as to what to do on a health level, or was it really pure politics?
Look, I think there's no question that politics has played into this pandemic. I mean, it's something that we've seen actually really from the beginning, but especially since May when this new government was formed. And there are countless examples, whether it was them trying to be popular when they were first sworn into office and making grossly fast decisions in order to open up transportation, culture, schools in a complete way, despite the fact that we knew that infection would rise if we had such a mass opening. And again, that was back in May, when you can think back to May 23rd, when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu got up there on the TV and said to everybody, go out and have a drink, as if the coronavirus had disappeared, even though worldwide, why did we think we were smarter than everybody else? And that was really a populist move. And we watched it throughout the entire summer as cases began to climb, that we saw that more and more political decisions were being made, or lack of decisions were being made for political reasons, until ultimately we were forced to lock down again in September. Now, we've really been on and off lockdown since September, with very small openings since then. And even as we talk about whether we're looking at how education will open, red zones, Haredi schools staying open while other schools are shut down, if you look at what happened at our airports and who was able to come in and go, you can see that almost every decision was rooted somehow in politics. I'd like to say that the health professionals gave good advice, that they definitely sat there and gave health recommendations. But I think in the end, you know, you ask somebody like the former coronavirus commissioner, Ronnie Gamzu, whether or not he feels politics played in, and he will tell you 100% yes.
It's also economics. I mean, it was the finance ministry versus the health ministry, for example.
But let me just add here also the other point, which ties back to what we were speaking about before with regards to Netanyahu's trial, right? Mm-hmm. The moment that you have, and this has been the problem since the beginning of his indictment and standing trial is that the moment that you have a prime minister who's supposed to lead a country at any time, forget about the pandemic, but especially during a pandemic, you need someone who is coming at it with the most, the purest of all intentions and motivations and clear of any personal interest. The moment that someone is indicted and on trial, that's no longer the case. And that changes everything. That makes it muddy. And therefore, every decision that Netanyahu has made from, for example, right, one of the most atrocious ones has been the failure to pass the state budget at a time that our economy, as Mayan said, is shot or is failing, right, with hundreds of thousands of people out of work. And why did he not pass the budget? It was because he wanted that after the government was formed with Blue and White, with Benny Gantz back in May, he wanted that exit point of not passing a budget so the government would fall and he could potentially go to an election, and he refused to pass a budget. Why did he want to go to election? He wanted to go to election one last time to get reelected, try one last time to get those 61 seats on the right that he could pass a bill that would then help him escape a trial. Those are wrong interests at a time, any time, but especially during a pandemic.
And perhaps specifically on the budget issue, would you think that that would appear obvious to your average, whatever that is, average voter in terms of coronavirus? You could say, well, no, they really didn't have the best intentions involved. It was really pure differences of opinion. The budget issue, wasn't it like really obvious why it wasn't passed, that this was purely a political issue and not an economic issue?
Look, you know, I think that you have to remember that people in Israel have short-term memories. You can know that because we've gone through three elections before this fourth where Netanyahu has continued to, say the same things and still get the same number of votes.
Right, he still gets over a million voters.
Right,
every time. And let's keep in mind that Netanyahu is reaching out right now to the Arab parties. It's as if we've forgotten, many people, that he was highly racist in the previous elections, anti-Arab. Go back even a few years, calling out, you know, the night of the election, the Arabs are going to the voting boxes, you know, to the voting booths, go out and make sure that you vote. And now he's courting Arab voters, saying he's going to make an Arab Israeli a minister. And I think with regards to the state budget, you know, people, you don't necessarily, interest groups understand the impact. Looked, right now going on is our discussion over the health basket, right? What drugs and technologies are going to be available for people from to take care of their health. And that budget, because the budget was not passed, the budget for the health basket did not change, which means we have 550 million shekels sitting for people when we have another billion shekels, at least, you know, that we need to account for. So, and that happens if you look across the board, whether we're talking education, whether we're talking unemployment benefits, whatever it is. No state budget means nobody's able to change their budget, and people are really feeling that. But they will forget when they get to the voting booth.
Mr. Netanyahu certainly takes pride. He promotes himself, and I think a lot of people view him as the world statesman in terms of his diplomatic connections, his ability, obviously, to negotiate, to talk to world leaders, his connections. And that played out not only in terms of whatever he's done diplomatically, but also in terms of Pfizer, right? And we get, therefore, that's the segue to get into how now it's the vaccination campaign, which everybody in the world is talking about how it's being done in Israel. The race between the skyrocketing, you know, the spiked numbers of people who are still getting it and with the variant, the mutation of COVID versus this massive race to get the vaccines. How is the Prime Minister, how are we as Israel doing with that?
Okay, so first of all, we do have to give credit to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for getting us those vaccines. He was able to do it because we have such a sophisticated data tracking system here in Israel. We work on electronic health records, and we're able to provide the data to Pfizer that they want and need in order to help them. This is very normal in a marketing phase to take data, you know, from a partner in order to help move forward, you know, the pitch that the vaccines are effective. So we do need to give him credit for that. It was his negotiation skills that got us there. But we don't need to give him credit in terms of our incredible vaccination campaign. I think that if you want to actually look at where we succeeded, it comes down to our health funds. I mean, there's a few reasons. I mean, first of all, we've had universal health care since before the founding of the states. Our health funds are over 100 years old, some of them. And we have been providing medical care to the people. But because our health funds are cradle to grave, meaning that generally speaking, only around 1% of people per year, if that, change health funds. Their doctors, their primary care physicians know them from a young age, and they track them in a system, which we run mass vaccination campaigns every year for the flu vaccine. We've done polio, we do measles. I mean, we're very used to this. So when it came time to be able to give out the vaccines here, this was something that we could do like rock stars. The other thing that we have, as I mentioned, is data and technology. So not only are we able to find those people, but then we're able to account. I'm about to get my second vaccine actually in a couple of days. And when I made my first appointment, I got my second one alongside it. I received a text message today reminding me that I have an appointment. These are things that we've been doing for a long time. We have almost every health fund has a sophisticated web platform where you can download your documents. These aren't things that exist in all necessarily other countries. So we've really been able to do it because of that. And the other thing that I would say is that we're great at emergencies. I mean,
we've
you're talking
a
about
experience.
A country.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. So many wars. And, you know, we're very patriotic in that way. So when you start to think about, you know, when the vaccination campaign started, when there are wars, we bring out milk and cookies and juice and we run to the soldiers and when they're in your area and protect them on the front lines, when it's, you know, protecting us in the city, when there are bus bombings. And here we're going out to the health funds. We're thanking the doctors. This is a patriotic country. It's a country that can move fast when it needs to. We're good at that. As we can see, we didn't manage the crisis well. The crisis is ongoing. Phase one went well, but now this has lasted almost a year, right? We're not so good at that. But quick emergencies.
So what's going to happen now? I mean, what do the following weeks, the ensuing weeks now, where do they take us in terms of reaching our goals? We're out, as we've been saying, we're exiting the lockdown, okay? And that could mean, I hope not, but according to some forecasts, a terrible spike in the numbers of people getting corona, perhaps dying from corona.
Well, you're going to see a lot more people die because the numbers of serious patients are still quite high. So I don't think the number is going to go down in terms of deaths. But in terms of the exit strategy, it's a question of if we follow an exit strategy or not. And our history has shown us that we are not very good at that for political reasons and others. But if we exit properly, there are mutations, but the more people over the age of 50 who are vaccinated, and right now we're a little over 80%, the more likely that you will have less serious patients. And this time, instead of tracking number of cases, we could have a lot of cases. We're going to track serious patients. We're going to track the number of people vaccinated. And hopefully that will allow us to exit and to live a somewhat normal life inside Israel with keeping our airports protected and be able to counter some of those variants. Obviously, it needs to be noted that all the vaccines that are on the market right now and that are approved, whether it's AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Moderna, we're finding are less effective or weaker against the South African variant specifically. They seem to work against the British variant. And there are more variants to come. The Brazilian variant also, we're seeing some challenges. There's a California variant, an Ohio variant, and a German variant. And you're going to see more and more popping up. And
soon the Israel variant.
Oh, gosh.
It's called politics and pandemic. But I just want to say one thing about the question about the vaccination. You mentioned, David, about how Netanyahu is this great statesman and uses his connections to be able to get the vaccines and Mayan. I agree. He deserves credit. But I think what you also see throughout this past year is that when he works on his own, Netanyahu, to get vaccines, to talk to the CEO of Pfizer, to get this amazing deal that we did where we got millions of vaccines to be able to inoculate the entire country in exchange for data. He's amazing, right? When it's that one-on-one diplomacy, Netanyahu is great. But when he has to work in a system, in a government that requires the integration and coordination with other ministries, other ministers, political adversaries who are now sitting as partners in his government, that's where he fails. And the reason he fails there is because there's political interests that start to get into the middle of everything. If I remember in the first lockdown wave of all of this, when Bennett was defense minister, Bennett was fighting, let the IDF take control, right? Wouldn't let the IDF. Why? Because he didn't want Bennett to get the credit. Then, I mean, so all along you saw these different steps of where politics got in the way of how to work together. But again, working one-on-one, getting Pfizer vaccines, no one's better.
And a very dire side of this pandemic, in addition, of course, to the health aspect and the economic aspect, is what our women's issues correspondent Tamar Be'eri has been highlighting, a shadow pandemic that has emerged, I'm sure, not just in Israel, but certainly in Israel, a shadow pandemic, they're calling it, that has emerged from the coronavirus, from COVID-19. Israel has seen a spike in sexual violence and domestic abuse in the last 6 months or so. And we're going to turn it over to Tamar for an interview with Orit Soluciano, the executive director of the Association of Rape Crisis Centers in Israel.
I am pleased to welcome Ohit Solitiano, Executive Director of the Association of Rape Crisis Centers in Israel. Ohit has over 20 years of experience in the fields of communications, public relations, and public campaigns, mainly concerning the status of women and the struggle to end violence against women. She served as the spokeswoman and director of Hebrew University's Public Relations Department for over 10 years, and before that, she served as the spokeswoman for the Israel Women's Network. Ohit has spent years working to advance women in politics, to advance the struggle against trafficking women, advancing the rights of agunot and delayed divorce, the struggle to end violence against women, and the advancement of women in academia. Ohit, thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Ohit, sexual abuse is a complex subject in Israel, but throughout the last year, it's not the only pandemic Israel has faced. The entire world has been completely ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic, and with it, Israel saw a 33% rise in reports of sexual abuse. How did the pandemic have such a drastic effect on these high numbers?
The pandemic is a very complex situation, which actually made the other a secret pandemic, as maybe you can call it, come out. You can imagine many houses where parents or siblings, there's an abuse in these houses. Usually, I should say one very important statistic. One out of five children in Israel suffered from sexual violence. This is the biggest research ever done in the country a few years ago, which surveyed 10,000 children in Israel. It's a big research done by a researcher from Haifa University. Now, imagine to yourself, there's a quarantine. The house is closed. The children are in the house, and the father or the brother is there. And what children could usually escape from, at least go in the morning to school, go to their friends, sort of avoid these abusive relationships, suddenly nowhere to go. No schools, no teachers, nobody that you can seize you. And in these houses, the children and the wives suffer very much. And that's why there was such a surge of of calls to the police and also to us, to the rape crisis centers in Israel. We, as the Association of Rape Crisis in Israel, are the umbrella organization of 9 centers. In our centers, we had a rise of 80% calls to our WhatsApp service, 50% rise to our online service, and 30% rise to just to the regular calls. And it's very interesting. If you analyze that, you can understand why was this huge rise to the online and WhatsApp services, because this was the only way somebody could take the phone secretly in the house and write something. You don't have to speak to nobody. That was very, very bad. And I want to tell you one more thing, that the implications of all this thing, we have not yet discovered the horrible implications.
I see. Do you believe that there are long-term effects of the coronavirus pandemic's sexual assault crisis?
I really believe so. And if you read, I will tell you that just every day in the Israeli newspapers in the past few weeks, there's a lot of articles stating, talking about the implications of the COVID on many issues, also on the mental health of the population. We can very easily understand that. I'm talking about the mental health. I'm talking about what will happen to these families when everything will be freed again, the children will go back to school, more wives will go to work. You know, there's a big problem of women, not only in Israel. We just heard about that in the States yesterday. Women are the 70% of the people who were fired or needed to leave the workplace were women, you know, because many of the jobs, like work in a store, working in a restaurant, women do these kind of jobs, and all these things are closed now. So the mental health of the population is in a big deterioration, but nobody can deal with that right now. So I'm very, very worried that after the pandemic, after the quarantine will finish and we'll slowly, slowly return back to normal lives, we will see very horrible problems. People going to hospitals, mental wards, children, you know, it takes time till the trauma of sexual violence comes out. This is a little bit different in the trauma when you're when a wife is suffers from a sexual from violence for a battered woman from her husband. You know, this is an immediate thing. You can see that. You can feel that. So women who are in a very very severe situation, they go to shelters for women who for battered women. But in sexual violence, this kind of phenomena, it takes time till it unveils. You know, it's like maybe an onion that slowly. You can see what's inside. And I'm very worried about that. And I can tell you one more thing that we see now. There is a huge, huge need for mental health treatment. The waiting time till you get this kind of service, public service, reaches 2 years. So if you now suffer from trauma, mental trauma, 2 years you need to wait, that's, you know, till the 2 years pass, you will be in a very horrible situation. If you don't have money and you need public funding, that's the situation in Israel right now.
What can the government do to advance such issues? What changes can they make?
First of all, we want to pray that we will have a stable government in Israel, because you know the chaotic situation here. So many elections and so much money goes on these campaigns. I want to cry when I think about that. I want to cry when I want to think about this money that instead of helping all the candidates get a seat, will help the social problems, are very horrible social problems in Israel. The government can do a lot. First of all, it's very, very basic in Israel. I should say something good about what's going on here. In Israel, there is an understanding that it's the government's responsibility to treat the victims. That's why both the health reform and the welfare system in Israel do subsidize or even for free give free public treatment. But because this service has such a huge demand, we have such long waiting lines. So and the Ministry of Treasury should give the Ministry of Welfare few millions of shekels to fund public treatment. This is an acute problem. This is part of your health. This is part of enabling a mother to take care of her children. I can tell you a lot of stories, if you would like to hear, about what happened to mothers, to families that suddenly collapsed because the mother, because of sexual trauma and because of the trigger of the COVID-19, suddenly could not do her everyday, could not be a mother, you know. We have many stories of women who really collapsed through the COVID-19. So this is a very, very important, and really, I think it's just something very essential and very basic. Like you drink water, you have to have good mental situation. So this is an acute problem, and we as an organization got funding to do a big report about what is the accessibility today, a research, what is the accessibility today for women and men, also men, I want to talk about the men, to mental health treatments. I want to tell you that we got calls from men who are from a Haredic communities or ultra-religious communities that suddenly, because of the COVID-19, they had to go back home, you know. Maybe they worked somewhere, the work was closed, no money to pay rent, returned back to the home. And who is in this home? The perpetrator. And maybe he does not hurt today, but just to see him triggers all the trauma. And also men suffer. So the government, this is an acute thing that she must take care, not only of putting the people in jail, but treating the population who is in big, big, big stress and strain and really very bad mental situation right now.
I see. What can families of those who are experiencing this kind of trauma do? What can be done to prevent the situations in the first place within the familial unit?
Yeah, this is, as you say, the million-dollar question. It's very complex. And, you know, the main thing, this is one of the things that we see as the most important thing the country should do, and we're not there at all. We think that every normal country, part of the educational system, every kid, you know, in the passes the Israel educational system, should, through the years, learn about what are the boundaries. What are the boundaries? What is okay and what is not okay? What is healthy sexuality is what, and what is not healthy? You know, my children, for example, when they were young, there was a big, it's still in Israel today, they learn in the first grade, second grade, third grade, the term, my body is my own. You know, like a little girl says, my body is my own, don't touch my body. This is very nice to learn that, but you can understand very deeply that when there is somebody who is very, very manipulative and he tells his little child, oh, you know, this is a secret between me and you, she doesn't know to tell my body is my own, and it does not help. So what should happen? And it does not happen today in Israel, that every child through our educational system has to learn through the years, have lessons on what is okay and what is not okay. We, in all of the rape crisis centers, subsidize and give dozens or hundreds of workshops to children, but this is all funded through philanthropy. Very good people who care about that, or some schools in Israel who really care about that. But this is not something which is systematic. And I tell you something which is very, very basic. You know, maybe even remember yourself when you were maybe in first grade, you learned how to cross a road, you know? When I was a little girl, I loved to draw, crossing in the street. And
crosswalk.
Because, yeah, and every child, you know, does it. I had this special little notebook and I learned all of the laws and the rules, how to cross the road, how to stand when there are traffic lights and so on. This is basic for life, I think, and we should know it, because sexual violence is not something unique. It's not something extraordinary. I'm very sad to say, but the more and more years I work in this field, I'm already 8 years the CEO of the Association of Rape Crisis Centers, I deeply understand that I'm very sad to say it's part of life. So many people suffer from sexual violence. Children are very vulnerable to that, because every adult who has problems can very easily assault a child. Very, very easy. It's very easy to do that. So kids have to learn that, and the schools have to put that in a systematic way. It does not happen today. It happens very sporadically. There is no regulation from the Ministry of Education, and there is no there's no even a demand from the Ministry of Education in Israel. When should that happen? It all depends on the goodwill and how much a principal of the school, a teacher or somebody from the school cares about that. This is not a way an educational system should work. And in the COVID-19 situation, when my kids and all the kids in Israel study through Zoom and could hardly stay hours, 8 hours through Zoom, that's even more problematic. So this should be part and an essential part of the Israeli education system, and educational system, every educational system.
Yeah, you spoke about Zoom. I'm curious, how does this movement to an online platform affect the tendencies of sexual abuse in Israel?
This is also a very good question, and there was a big rise of reports to the 105 service in Israel, which is online sexual abuse and online bullying and all of the online problems. The Zoom enables, and it's bigger than just sexual abuse, it's abuse of children who can, through the Zoom and through the internet, bully each other and also shame each other and assault. I can tell you one thing. I've got a girl, she's in seventh grade, and all the time with this, over the computer, the internet. If you are in a family who has problems, or you have all kinds of despair or emotional problems, and you're a young girl, you could be bored and suddenly get somebody in your Instagram sending you all kinds of messages. How are you? And if you're very, very lonely, maybe, and you don't have parents who look what you're doing, this young girl or young boy can have some adult somewhere starting to assault them. sending them photographs, asking them to do all kinds of things. This is a big problem in the country. And again, it all, the family is a basic unit, but it depends about the family, who gives help to the families. This is a big problem that all of the world has to deal with. And in order to deal with that, you have to have, again, the child with all the surroundings, the educational surrounding, the parents, and the family. But it's usually, you know, what I see, I meet grown-up women who were assaulted when they were young. And I see many times that the assault sometimes happens when something happens in the family. For example, you have a mother or father who is very, very ill in the hospital. And so the parents are concentrated in taking care of each other, or maybe an ill child, or maybe some kind of other problems. Suddenly the child is alone. And these kind of situations make the children more at risk. So I think the system should be alert, but it has to be a program to see the big picture and not just deal with the cases and the specific cases and how to help. And today in Israel, we've got so many problems and nobody deal with that in a systematic way. And this is our big cry. You know, 70% of the people who are in the psychiatric wards or go to get mental treatment, up to 70%, suffered when they were young or sometimes from sexual violence. It's really a widespread problem, and it makes many things collapse.
Wow, that's a horrible number.
Yeah, but it's really, you know, first when I came to this job, I heard about incest. I heard that one to seven kids suffer from incest. I thought to myself, wow, that's amazing. Now when I'm working, I really meet these people. It's really all over. It's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that. But that is the truth. And if once we acknowledge the data, the situation, then we have the tools to make change. The first thing is naming, as you say, naming the situation, claiming that this is the reality, and then work for change. But we're not there yet, and it's very, very sad to see how lives of people are affected, and if they got the help in time, many things could be changed. And it's also a generational thing, you know, children who grow in these kind of families, when suddenly usually it's the mother collapses because she suffered once from sexual violence, then what happens to the child? You know, it can be more generations of this kind of problems.
I see. All right.
I'm sorry, you seem very worried, and I'm really, I mean, it's not easy to hear that. It's very hard, but, you know, you can do a lot. We do a lot to change, and there is a lot to be done to change, and that's why I'm optimistic. But it's not easy. It's really not easy. And I'm very sorry to make you and the people who will hear this podcast sad. But you have to acknowledge that this is part of life. It's social, very sad social phenomena. But and we have to fight to make the numbers smaller.
See. Thank you, Orit, for your fight on the subject. Thank you for being here with us today. This was a very enlightening discussion.
And thank you so much. It's very good of me to add that if somebody hears that and wants to call or consult with us, maybe it's good that I'll tell at least the two main numbers. It's 1202 hotline for women who suffer from sexual violence, and 1203 for men who suffer from sexual violence. And we have special numbers for the Arab community and the religious community, and a chat online. It all could be found through the social media, but this is the two main numbers. And we thank you so much for your interest and care on this issue.
Thank you, Ori.
So thank you so much for tuning in to the first edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast. Why don't we end with the following warming, heart-rending story, though, finally, of the loss of a 105-year-old Holocaust survivor who died on February 7th. Her name was Shoshana Ovitz. She survived Auschwitz, and she watched her mother being handed over to the infamous Nazi doctor and so-called angel of death, Joseph Mengele. She, Shoshana Ovitz, became famous last year before coronavirus when she celebrated her 104th birthday at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. There, she snapped a photo with her descendants, all 400 of them. Thank you for listening. You'll be hearing from us at least every week. We look forward to sharing our views on the news with you here on the Jerusalem Post podcast.